Welcome, everyone. The subcommittee will come to order. I want to thank at the outset the people at the Grand Center for assisting us with this. Berlin Striblin, who's the director of the Grand Center, along with Jordy Eastwood, Joe Thurston, and Matt Seneceros. Thank you for welcoming us. Thanks to all of you for coming to this important event. And I want to welcome you to our roundtable meeting of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Subcommittee on Public Lands, Forests, and Mining. We are honored to have a number of distinguished guests with us today, who we will introduce in a moment, including one who I will mention at the outset, my friend and colleague from Alaska, Senator Lisa Murkowski, who is the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, of which the Public Lands Committee is a subcommittee. Today we're going to examine some examples of successful state management of state and federal public lands here in Utah. I want to again welcome my friend and colleague from Alaska, Senator Murkowski, who's the chairman of the full committee, and she's a champion for responsible use and conservation and responsible development and access to federal public lands. So welcome to Moab, Senator Murkowski, and to Utah. I hope today's roundtable will help us to expand our statewide and our national conversation about public lands, about why we have them, about how we use them, and how best we can preserve them for our future generations. We can't continue to talk about public lands as if they were one single monolithic thing, because they're not. The term public lands tends inappropriately to group disparate and different types of lands with major differences into one single definition, one that doesn't match every use. Back in D.C., for example, many of my colleagues tend not to understand that not all federal lands look like Arches National Park, which we were pleased to have visited just a few moments ago, or that there is a distinction between state public lands and federal public lands. It is, I believe, time to have a more balanced conversation about the many important uses amongst the many forms of public lands. Some of us may be familiar with the four major federal land agencies, including the National Park Service, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. These are agencies that together manage 640 million acres of land across the United States. However, it's important to remember that across the states, you also have state-owned lands. In particular, state trust lands are an often overlooked category of public lands, and yet they're important to consider in this mix as well. Interspersed with federal lands, tribal lands, and other forms of government-owned property in the West are 46 million acres of state-owned trust lands. 86% of those are located in just 9 western states: Utah, Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, New Mexico, Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming. In many instances, the origins of state trust lands predate the federal land management agencies themselves and the laws that they're charged with implementing, in some cases by many decades. Beginning with Ohio, with its admission into the Union in 1803, and ending with Arizona and New Mexico in 1910, every state entering the Union in the continental United States was granted certain sections of land by Congress under their respective statehood enabling acts. That's a whole lot of states. That's, in fact, a solid majority, a supermajority of the states in our Union that have been admitted that way and with those kinds of provisions in their enabling legislation. Particularly in western states, trust lands were set aside under stringent requirements to generate revenue to support state beneficiaries, primarily and most importantly in our state, kindergarten through grade 12 public education. In fact, our primary and secondary public education is the beneficiary from our state institutional trust lands administration. Indeed, state trust lands generate significant revenue through the same forms of multiple use activities occurring on federal land, including in some instances oil and gas leasing, timber, mining, outdoor recreation, conservation, and other activities. And while state trust lands are not strictly public land in the same sense as many federal lands, there is a success story to be heard when it comes to state land management. In Utah, state trust lands generated $82.7 million for K-12 public schools in fiscal year 2019, funds that went straight to our local school districts where they could be used to help educate our children. Another $3.9 million went to other statehood beneficiaries like the Utah Miners Hospital, Utah Schools for the Deaf and Blind, and the College of Mines at the University of Utah, just to name a few. In total, the State of Utah School and Institutional Trust Lands Administration, or SITLA, has assets valued at nearly $2.5 billion. Other states similarly benefit. In Wyoming and in Arizona, trust lands have built up a roughly $1 billion public education fund. The state of New Mexico alone has done remarkably well in this area, having amassed an astoundingly large $19 billion endowment, largely because of oil and gas production on trust lands, 82% of which are set aside specifically for public education. States have also demonstrated that they can not only manage these lands well in a way that benefits public education and other important public uses, but that they can also do so in an environmentally responsible fashion. They can perform excellent ecological restoration work, increasingly, but still not often enough. The federal land management agencies are turning to states and to local governments for help to accelerate the pace of critical restoration work on federal lands when bad things happen. Now, this is no coincidence. It's no accident that they turn to states and local entities. These are the places where people are most directly affected by what happens on those lands. When an environmental disaster occurs through a forest fire or otherwise, the people on the ground feel it first. They feel it most. And their state and local governments step in to act to help carry that burden. And very often, they do a disproportionate share of it. Federal laws like the Good Neighbor Authority have allowed states to plan and execute tree thinning and forest restoration projects, especially on fire-prone federal land, where fuel very often builds up and can lead to devastating forest fires. The Recreation and Public Purposes Act has allowed states and local governments to unlock outdoor recreation opportunities on federal lands that otherwise would have been either abandoned on the one hand, or in many cases simply underutilized, or both. And initiatives like the Shared Stewardship Program at the U.S. Department of Agriculture are empowering state governments to have a say in how and where the Forest Service prioritizes hazardous fuels projects on federal lands within a particular state's own borders. States like Utah have a proven track record of successful partnerships with the Forest Service and with the Bureau of Land Management. These partnerships have resulted in the restoration of millions of acres of high-priority watersheds, wildlife habitat, and of rangelands. We need to continue to expand and encourage these kinds of efforts to allow states to step up and lead so that we can restore landscapes across boundaries and so that we can maintain the purity of the environment in places that have been scarred. States are some of the best stewards of the land, and the federal government should do more to allow states and their political subdivisions to lead those efforts, to be the lead managers so that they can protect those they're elected to serve. Our panel today includes a number of participants who are here to share their perspectives on state land management. We're joined by Congressman John Curtis, who represents Utah's 3rd Congressional District, including Moab. Welcome, John. Congressman Rob Bishop from Utah, who's also the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee and the former chairman of that committee. Thanks for being here, Rob. And we've got Congressman Paul Gosar from our neighboring state of Arizona. Congressman Gosar is the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on public lands. We're grateful to each of you for joining us in the Senate. We don't always sit together as senators and congressmen, but we're glad when we have the opportunity to do so. We're also very pleased to have with us the Honorable Curtis Wells, a council member from here at Grand County. Welcome, sir. State Representative Carl Albrecht, who is a member of the Utah State Legislature. Mr. David Ure, who's the director of the Utah School Institutional Trust Lands Administration, or SITLA. Our Utah State Forester, Brian Cottom. And finally, last but not least, Kathleen Clark, who's the director of the Utah Public Lands Policy Coordination Office in Governor Herbert's administration. She's also got the longest title, which therefore means she's the most important. And thanks to all of you for being here today. And now we're going to hear a few words from my colleague and the chairman of our committee, Senator Lisa Murkowski.
Senator Lee, thank you. Thank you for the invitation to be with you in Utah today. Thank you for the work that you have done and continue to do on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, the work that you have done in focusing on our public lands and the priorities of our public lands is greatly, greatly appreciated. I'm not only appreciative of the opportunity to have this discussion here today, but for the opportunity for me as a Westerner, as far west as you can go, and from a big state, a big public land state, to be in Utah and to see the many shared issues that our states share. I think sometimes when we're dealing with challenging lands issues, when we deal with the tensions, the inherent tensions between federal management, state management, local management, tribal management, you tend to feel that your problems are your own and nobody else gets it. And so when you have an opportunity to come out and to see some of the commonalities, some of the shared interests, and to try to better understand how we can learn from one another, this is where I think not only this field hearing, but also the opportunity to see from the air and from the ground some of these issues that we're facing. We recognize that our public lands produce clean water, clean air, energy, minerals, livestock, timber, among other outputs that we rely on every day. They also provide scenic beauty. You certainly have extraordinary, extraordinary beauty here in your state. Outdoor recreation opportunities that are unparalleled. Habitat for wildlife. For many Western communities, public lands drive your economic development, the job creation, and the funding for essential community services. Our forests and our rangelands truly are lands of many uses and many users. And I think that's an important part of us to all recognize is these lands are not monolithic. Our public lands are for one certain thing. It is many uses and many users. I have enjoyed looking at the maps as we have traveled throughout the day today, and to see the checkerboard that you have here in Utah of your public lands. And I compare it to what I have in my state, where it's just this crazy patchwork of color between what we have with BLM, Forest Service, Park Service, our state lands, our native lands, our military lands. The one little tiny itty-bitty teeny-weeny dot that you can't see is the amount of land that is held in private hand, less than 1%. I come from a state that is about 365 million acres. We like to tell our colleagues from Texas that we're twice as large as Texas and then some. But think about it. An area that's one-fifth the size of the United States of America, twice the size of Texas, and 90% of our land is in public ownership. So of that public ownership, about 62-63% in there is held in the federal estate. When Alaska became a state in 1959, Congress granted 105 million acres of territory land to the state of Alaska. And it's now almost 60 years later, we're still waiting for those full conveyances. That is an issue that we are wrestling with. But when you think about the land grant that we have in a state like ours, broader in purpose than most Western states, but it was really intended to promote development, settlement, and infrastructure. We do have some trust lands, and I have been very interested to understand a little bit more about what you are doing here in the state of Utah and how you manage that. The state of Alaska manages about 1.2 million acres of state land for mental health services and public education under what we call the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Back in 2018, sales of trust lands generated $20 million for mental health providers, nonprofits, state and local governments, and tribal communities. They also manage timberlands that generate revenue through timber sales, and these programs that generate these revenues serve and support special needs families, the care of Alzheimer's patients, opioid addiction treatment, other services that are otherwise virtually impossible to deliver in some of our very remote areas of the state. So I do understand how important it is for our state land agencies to manage its assets in the best interests of its beneficiaries. As I mentioned, in my state, over 60% of all land in the state, 222 million acres, is under federal ownership. The balance between the multiple uses of our BLM and Forest Service lands is critical for healthy, sustainable rural communities. But there is a very significant tension, and I know this is a hearing about Utah, but I just share, as we were flying down here today, I look out and I see roads in a lot of areas that I kind of had assumed were not roaded areas. I was born in the southeastern part of the state, where it's effectively, we live in the Tongass National Forest. It accounts for 80% of the land base in southeast Alaska. It's 16.7 million acres in size. It's the largest national forest in the country. It's in size, it's larger than the state of West Virginia. Just trying to put things in context. But within this area, the population is pretty small. There's 32 islanded communities, but they're all islands. Okay, so you're limited in infrastructure there. You don't have roads that connect you. You're reliant on hydro, which is a good thing, but hydro requires some transmission. And it is a national forest. It is an incredible national forest, but we're dealing with a federal rule, the roadless rule, that not only inhibits the ability to have a small timber-based economy, but really a limitation and almost a prohibition for much of anything else. If you want to try to put a transmission line in to connect your hydro resource without being able to build a road, it's pretty tough. So we have these tensions that are significant. But I think it is important that as we are working to address these tensions, that our state and our federal governments work together to create the partnerships, because we know the federal government can't get all the work done it needs. And we know that those who are closer to the land, those who live and work and raise their families here, they understand it. Wildfire management is a perfect example of one of those areas, if you will. Wildfires know no boundaries, and we saw some of that flying over. We have prolific wildfires. We had a pretty tough year this year, about 2.5 million acres burned, more wildfires than any other state, at least at this point in time, one of the most expensive fires. So this federal-state relationship is really important to us in how you manage your lands, how you manage your fires. So working to understand who is doing what well so that we can share best practices, so that we can build on the commonalities that we have. This is what we're attempting to do today. So again, Senator Lee, thank you for your good work on public lands issues. And I look forward to hearing from you, being educated more this afternoon on how we can, through collaboration, through good stewardships, do right by our lands, our waters, and our country. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm trying to remember something. Didn't you tell me one time, Lisa, that Alaska is both the furthest west state and also the easternmost state in the United States?
We go full circle.
Yeah. With the Aleutian Islands, you have some of them that are technically in the...
There's one hanging over the international dateline.
That's fantastic.
We can take you places.
You cover a lot of territory. That's fantastic. Okay, I'm going to kick off some questions now to get some of this conversation going, and we'll jump right into it. We'll start with you, David Ure. I want you to tell us a little bit about the difference between trust lands and other types of public lands. Tell us a little bit about your beneficiaries, what it means to work in a trust on behalf of the beneficiaries and how they get involved.
First of all, let me tell you that we have 3.4 million acres of surface, 4.3 million of subsurface, and so we have split surface in one way or another. Let me also give you a little background about myself. Brigham Young hated my great-great-grandfather bad enough that he sent him to Kansas. And so I'm the fourth generation raised on the original 95 acres of Brigham Young granted my great-great-grandfather. Today, that farm is producing 5 to 7 times more beef, more hay, and up until 4 years ago, more milk than my great-great-grandfather did. And I truly believe I have not impaired the environment one bit. I believe that I have actually cleaned the environment up because I have a corral, if I might say, any runoff. So it's not going downstream, I'm not polluting anything else, I'm running more cows on my ground than I did before. So with that preface of where I come from the opportunity of managing these grounds. And as the Supreme Court said in 1994, sit the grounds are likened to private. We have the ability as private owners, and one of the problems that we have at SITLA is that beneficiaries does not mean the public as a whole. It does not mean other government agencies. It means I am responsible to my beneficiaries who the enabling clause in 1894 established who they were. And I can give you a quick rundown. University of Utah, School of Mines, Mining Hospital, Utah State University, State Teaching Colleges, School of the Deaf, School of the Blind, Public Buildings, Juvenile Justice, Utah State Hospital, Reservoirs, but 94% of our land is owned by our public schools. But I have that many bosses, and those bosses are of a trust law type. And my understanding, being just a dairy farmer, trust law is a little bit of a higher standard than the normal law. They have a fiduciary responsibility to protect their assets. And believe me, they are looking over my shoulder every minute of every day because I have full access to my building. Having said that, the purpose of SITLA is also not only to make a dollar today that my board of trustees argues about every board meeting, but they also look about the future of trust lands. Is this piece of ground going to be more valuable to my great-grandchildren in 100 years from now as open space or whatever it might be? Or do I capitalize today and build the trust fund up and with the ability to invest it, we get 7% return? But we're not just a rape and plunder organization. We look
not
forward.
Just, or...
Whichever. My point is, we have a responsibility to take care of the future as well as the present. And we try very hard to. If I were to say one thing that I think SITLA has worked on very hard over the last 3 years, is working with county commissioners and with cities. As a matter of fact, we're starting to work to where the public comes in and loots our ground and puts graffiti on the walls. We work together. They are our sheriff. They are our watch eyes. We have 72 employees working over 3.4 million acres. So it's a camaraderie. It's a partnership. And the public uses our lands as if they're their own. And sometimes it's our biggest detriment, because sometimes we can't go in and claim our lands when we have a good opportunity to economically make money today, because the public thinks that they're theirs and they're not. And that then causes trouble. But we still work within the community because we want a better project for the public as a whole.
If I can just ask, how do you educate the public then about that distinction between the difference between trust lands and public lands?
It is an ongoing battle, Senator. Let me just tell you experience in the last 30, 40 days. I have been taking out little plastic checks, because the money's already been given to the county commissioners, because most counties have settler ground inside their county. We're in Grand County right now. I presented them with a plastic check. I think it was either $288,000 or $320,000, I remember, because we pay 87 cents for every acre that's in a county. I take this opportunity to give them what I call a Sitwell 101 of how we're reestablished, and giving them a PowerPoint of the Supreme Court, of the enabling clause of the Constitution, and what the legislature has empowered me to do. It's an ongoing battle, but probably the key is we have community councils in every school building. I mean, if there's 5 elementaries, we have a community council in that building, each individual. And there's training that goes on to teach them where the money is coming from that we return to them. Like last year was $82 million. It's an ongoing battle, Senator. It never dies. You have to keep doing it every year.
Congressman Bishop, long-time chairman of the House Energy and Natural or the House Natural Resources Committee, and now the ranking member, what can you tell me, in your view, are some of the misconceptions about the differences between state and federal public land?
The biggest misconception is that there has to be an either-or or a difference as far as the purpose and the management of land. You got a perfect example here in the county where Sand Flats recreational area, still BLM land, 10, 15 years ago, was not being managed by BLM at all. It was a great destination point for kids in spring break, but you almost had riots breaking out here until BLM, not out of because they were disingenuous about anything, they just didn't have the manpower to cover it. They made an agreement with the county, so the county now administers that program, administers those lands. They do it. It's a great recreation spot. One of the state park, what is it, Coral Sand Dunes, down in Kane County, has been listed in the last decade as one of the top 10 parks in the nation, and that was federal land that under the Recreation and Public Purposes Act was turned over to the state. The state manages it as a public recreation area. That's a great destination spot. Same thing like we do with Antelope Island. Sometimes, if you go over to the county line with Emory County, it's a perfect example, once again, a couple of years ago. I think it's around the Goblin Valley area, a little bit south of that. They have some public parking over in that particular area and some great trails. Unfortunately, some of the trails come to crosses where if you go right, you go back to your car at the parking lot. If you go left, you end up dead. And it was the county that was begging BLM to please put up some kind of signage so people knew where to go. And the BLM at that time, because they said they didn't have the money for signs, and also it would change the view shed of that particular area, refused to do it. Until one day, a lady, who a lot of it was mistakes she made, actually got lost, took the wrong road, and she died. Emory County had to simply go in there and rescue the remains. After that, then BLM put up the signs, and all of a sudden, those problems kind of disappeared. That's the kind of cooperation that we should be talking about. It is not an either-or situation. It's not only the federal government can have public lands, or the state can, or the county can, but in reality, all of them should be. One of the things we have tried to do when we created the new national park in my county, now National Park, in Box Elder, the Golden Spike Park, is to create a collaborative citizen panel that not only is there to give advice, but also is there to actually veto things that the Park Service would like to do that are incompatible with what those neighbors in that area want to have happen. That's what we're trying to do, is give more people a chance to say what they would like to do on public land. And it can be done. It doesn't have to be an either-or situation. Is that what you were after, sir?
Absolutely. Thank you. So in many instances, it comes down to a difference between how far the ultimate decision-maker lives from the land in question. In the case of the land you're describing, it might have been a few miles. It might have been someone who the people frequenting that park might see at the grocery store or at a Little League game. In the case of federal land managers, ultimate authority might stretch 1,800 miles back to Washington. Those do make a difference. And yet, Kathleen Clark, this sometimes makes a difference. Sometimes there is a perception that states, state government agencies, lack the expertise and the technical know-how in order to manage public lands effectively. You bring a unique perspective to this in that as both a state official now and as a former BLM director, you've seen it from both sides. What can you tell me about what you think about this perception?
I can speak firsthand about the technical expertise, the capability, and the willingness of Utahns to participate in the management of federal land. We work very, very closely with the Bureau of Land Management and with the Forest Service in designing sage-grouse plans. We found that the state had local working groups in the 11 strongholds of sage-grouse throughout the state. And unlike other states that may have had one plan or a federal government that had two plans, the state of Utah had 11. Because all of those areas were very different. Different ecology, different geology, different challenges, and very different threats. And it was the reliance on the local people who had gathered data and worked with the universities for literally decades that we had superior science and were able to inform that decision making. So I find that local people, when given the opportunity, are tremendous partners. We right now are enjoying great partnerships with our federal agencies, and we get more done. And when you've got both parties committed, you're going to have stewards that will watch out for something, even after that federal person you work with gets transferred. You have some longevity. When I was at BLM, I'd occasionally have a manager of an area say, oh my gosh, I had a public meeting and there were 400 people there and they all want to be involved. And I said, lucky you. I said, if you manage that crew, that 400 bunch, you're going to have a team that is going to champion the decisions that are made. They're going to own them and they're going to manage them and expand the workforce in your area like you can't even imagine. So I think there's wonderful opportunities for the federal government to recognize and tap in to the strengths, the passion, the energy, the local wisdom of the people who live there.
Congressman Gosar, you've got a fair amount of public lands in your state, some of which are federal and some of which are not. What's your perspective on the difference in quality of management and the differences in terms of their ability to respond to environmental needs and recreation needs?
Well, I would bring up particularly the forestry aspect and timber. You know, we've had catastrophic fires on it, and the two most catastrophic in Arizona history, I was an office boy. The Wallow Fire being the largest fire in Arizona history, and then the Yarnell Fire that was the most catastrophic for human life, where 19 firefighters actually lost their life on a fast-moving fire. So the government is very slow in its matriculation on forests. All forests are very different. Our forests, our ponderosa forests, are typically 40 to 50 trees per acre. And much of the rim country is anywhere from 800 to 1,100 trees per acre. And what this does is fire was a dynamic part of our forest. But because it's so stacked full, what ends up happening, the fire changes in its dynamics. These big catastrophic fires burn hotter now instead of staying on the house floor, on the forest floor. and you get incineration of topsoil microbes, and you get sterilization of soil. But we see a very slow apparatus from the federal government, whereas the state is much more responsive and much more reactive. And they're stewards. Flagstaff is a pretty liberal bastion in Arizona. And now what they're looking at is they're kind of the example of thinning that forest in collaborative action that is meaningful and gets it back to ecological balance.
So in that area, people are seeing that regardless of someone's where someone fits on the ideological spectrum, even especially if they are most concerned about the impact on the environment, they're wanting to make sure that they have the opportunity to manage the forest in a way that protects it from catastrophic environmental devastation.
Absolutely. I mean, the people on the ground have to live with the consequences. And so those are the biggest keys. When you're about ready to lose everything, and that's where a lot of this started changing, you know, we were 5 minutes away with the fire just south of Flagstaff, that if 5 minutes later, if they hadn't got to it, it would have taken out the town. Those are pretty catastrophic accidents.
Congressman Curtis, you've got a lot of public lands in your district, and you're an avid outdoorsman and someone who enjoys public lands a lot. What worries you most about public lands in our state and in your district?
Thank you. I'm glad you asked that question slightly different of me than the others, because I truly worry about the dialogue that happens between our state and Washington, D.C. with public lands. If you look at this map up here, you clearly see this disproportionate amount of public lands out in the West. And there are a lot of people, as those here from Washington can attest, that speak up in Washington, D.C. about the national interest in these public lands. There's almost no one back in Washington, D.C. speaking up about the problems inherent with public lands in these states. So if you'll indulge me for just a minute, I want to click off just a few that I do think it's really important that Washington, D.C. understands these dynamics. The first one I would say is simply revenue. Having been a former mayor, I know that cities and towns and counties get the bulk of their money from property tax. It's the primary source of revenue. Well, imagine trying to run a city, a town, or a county when 90%+ of your land does not generate property tax. This is how we pay for police and fire and roads and parks and schools, and all those fundamental things that we do in our cities and towns. The lack of understanding that in Washington, D.C. puts huge pressure on the dialogue, and we try to compensate for that with payment in lieu of taxes funds that come. They come on an irregular basis, and they come at a fraction of the amount that property would pay if it was in public hands. So acknowledging that, I think, is just incredibly important. The second thing I would bring up is the divisiveness that comes from this divide in our country. It's hard for people in Washington, D.C. to feel it, but many of you here know what I'm talking about. It breeds divisiveness and pits people against each other, which is really unfortunate. The third thing is economic development. Imagine if you were to take the half of the United States that is so much white and say, look, we have a plan that's going to wipe out you and your family and the way that you have generated money for decades. And this is what's happening with grazing and extraction and things like that. And without understanding economic impact of decisions that we make in Washington, D.C. on people who for generations have depended on the land for that, I think is a mistake. And then finally, the fourth point that I would bring up is the inability of the federal government to fund what it takes to manage these massive amounts of land, despite, in many times, their best efforts. And I'll just use the example down in San Juan County of two BLM agents tasked with managing that entire area. There's no way, right, that they can be successful at that. And the need to bring the state, county, and towns in is just simply because of the lack of the resources. And I just simply bring up those four things and wish that there were more people spreading that message in Washington, D.C., because if you're not taking those four things into consideration, it's near impossible to find answers on these difficult public lands issues.
Okay. Brian Cottom, as the state forester, you oversee the management of a lot of state lands. Have you felt that you have the resources that are adequate, that are sufficient to enable you to manage those lands in an environmentally responsible fashion? And how would you compare your ability to manage those as compared to that of your federal counterparts?
Thanks, Senator. So there's a couple of things when it comes to our Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. We're one of seven divisions within the state's Department of Natural Resources. I'm one of a few state forestry divisions that actually does not manage any state forest land. We have forested land that the state owns, but it's managed by wildlife resources or several other state parks. My division does manage our state sovereign lands, our submerged lands, 1.5 million acres, 2,200 miles of shoreline. It's a huge responsibility. For example, we own the state forest where I manage the Great Salt Lake, a lot of things, all the industries on the Great Salt Lake, we have their leases. And I'll tell you unequivocally, yes, the legislature has been extremely supportive of our efforts to be proactive and to get work done on our state sovereign lands. But I think the bigger responsibility that I have as the state forester is our partnership with the Forest Service particularly, but also with the Bureau of Land Management when it comes to the statutory responsibility that we have to protect our communities, our infrastructure, our water sources from wildfire, even the duty that I have as the state forester to do that, and I don't control that land. So we have to work incredibly hard, creatively, to figure out how do we partner with those federal agencies, how do we compel them to get the work done that needs to be done in order to protect our communities, and all across DNR, whether it's Wildlife Resources and Watershed Restoration Initiative, our division, state parks and the things that they do, we get things done in the state of Utah because we are creative, because we partner, because the legislature is extremely supportive of the work that we do and we go and ask for the funds in order to get things done. Even to the point now that our legislature is appropriating funding for our division to be able to get work done on federal lands, state dollars, but on federal lands because they don't have the resources to get it done.
Can I interrupt and ask you about that? Can you give me an example of that, where you're actually using state dollars to help assist on the federal side?
Yep. So there are a number of different examples. The Watershed Restoration Initiative is probably the very best that we have in Utah. It's been in place for 14 years. The state appropriates money that is then pooled with federal dollars with a number of other actors. Up to 500 partners have put money into the Watershed Restoration Initiative. Get nearly 200 million or 2 million acres treated over 14 years. And whether it's state money or other partners' money, it gets distributed out. My division has also been beneficiary of the legislature's interest in wildfire risk reduction. And just this past year, at the risk of offending legislators right there, they provided $2 million this past year to do timber work, forestry work, wildfire risk reduction work on National Forest System lands. I believe they're going to continue those appropriations because the Forest Service doesn't have the money to get the work done. So we've got a few different examples in Utah where it's happening.
Have you ever encountered circumstances where you can see an environmental catastrophe or a public safety problem developing on federal public land, but because you don't control the levers of authority relative to that land, you're unable to do anything because your federal counterparts are unable or unwilling to act?
Every day. And probably the most extreme example that we have in Utah and Garfield County is the Anguish City watershed that was burned over by the Brianhead fire a couple of years ago. And for years, I've been able to do this kind of work all across rural Utah. For years, we worked with the Forest Service trying to get them to focus on the area, to do something about it. We knew it was going to burn. Sure enough, the Brianhead fire had burned. It did not need to burn. We have examples of that, unfortunately, across the state. We know where the problems are. We know where the wildfire risk is. We know where our infrastructure is. We can get this work done. We've got to maintain those relationships with those federal agencies to compel them with us to get the projects done.
So that's a certain, and you said this happens every day. And in that particular circumstance, you saw harm coming to people and to property and to watersheds and to the environment. And you were unable to act because you didn't have the authority, because it was held by federal officials who were not you.
Yes, sir.
Councilman Wells, tell me a little bit about your perspective. As a local in some of the most beautiful real estate in the world, with surrounded by some of our greatest crown jewel public lands. What's your perspective on the role of your local government here?
Well, Brigham Young loved my great-great-great-grandfather so much that he sent him to Mola. And
it was barefoot.
We've been ranchers grazing. Moab was an orchard community around the turn of the century. Natural resource development and now tourism. And Grand County is approximately 2.4 million acres of public land. Over 90% of that is federal. And so we see a lot of the challenges, you know, at the boots on the ground level of a county of that size with that much land mass. But a lot of limitations in what we can do. So Congressman Curtis mentioned PILT. PILT is really, you know, some issue that we talk about, and I've been back to D.C. a couple of times, and we're lobbying representatives to, you know, to make the full payment. But we all know that PILT is pennies and move trillions. It's really entirely inadequate to compensate these counties and these rural areas for the services and the work that we need to do to provide infrastructure and a quality of life for our citizens. And so that's something that's a discussion that needs, you know, realizing the budget with the federal government is tough. But there's a trade-off. If the federal government, you see, you know, signs in the back that says keep public hands, lands in public hands, the way that reads to me is put federal lands in public hands. If the federal government is going to own land, that much land in Grand County, there's got to be adequate compensation for it. And the answer to that is to not beef up federal agencies. The answer is local control, the system that we've bought into. Sheriff, search and rescue, Congressman Bishop mentioned Sand Flats Recreation Area, home of the first motorcycle mountain bike trail in Moab, Utah, land owned by the BLM, managed by the county, balanced budget. They successfully manage overlapping interests between all different kinds of recreation user groups. They do it really well. They know these people, they have the relationships, they know the land the best. And so the discussion, you know, watching the Public Lands Initiative and everything kind of take place is, CITLA is not the model for state land management. And that's the debate and the misconception of the conversation that we're trying to have. Is privatization and economic development is not the face of state land management. It's state agencies, and I can tell you that as a local representative here, I'd much rather worry about the politics of Salt Lake City than the politics of Washington, D.C. And the relationships that we have with the state are really vital. My representative, Governor's Office of Public Lands, Mr. Dave Yore, those relationships is what really matters in public land management. And, you know, as a local representative, we need to have seeing the debate and the conversation segue from state management of the land as privatization to how well is the state managing the land. In fact, they're doing a great job with the resources that they have and the overlap that they have on federal land. And so,
may I ask a question there? Because I think we clearly understand the great value that our public lands, particularly out in an area like this where you have national parks and state parks that the world wants to come and see. And this community here is clearly the beneficiary of that. But best as I can tell, and I haven't been through the whole town, it's not that big of a town. Your infrastructure, your resources are limited. Your capacity is limited as a community. So you want to be that good host community to all of these folks that come in. But what kind of pressures are on you, I guess, resource pressures in terms of capacity? During the summer, you've got lots of folks coming in that puts pressure on your hospital, your search and rescue. Walk me through a little bit of that.
So Grant County is a fifth-class county. So we have a permanent population of less than 10,000 residents. Just Arches National Park alone draws over 3 million visitors a year. So that number overall, southeastern Utah, is closer to 4 million. So to give you an idea, we are servicing the infrastructure needs and the community needs on the budget of a fifth-class county with this tax base, with the demands of a first-class county and up. I mean, and so it's you know, the way I equate it is it's a 100-pound frame carrying a 500-pound body. You know, and it's hard to pull that value from the locals to pay for these accommodations and the infrastructure and the things that these visitors are wanting to, you know, the quality of experience they're wanting to have when they're here on a tax base off of less than, you know, 5-6% of the land.
But going back to PILT, that is one reason why PILT is so important out in this region, because you don't have, and you won't have that tax base.
That's absolutely right. And I think it's as simple as if the federal government is going to hold the title to these lands within our boundary in Grant County, and we serve with the powers of the state legislature and the government, they should pay adequate compensation for that.
And in fact, as the title of the program itself suggests, PILT is the program that stands for Payment in Lieu of Taxes. The idea behind it is to compensate the state property taxing jurisdiction, in the case of our state and most states, the county, for federal public land ownership within that county's boundaries, given the fact that the federal government has told states they can't tax federal land. The idea is for the federal government to compensate the counties for the shortfall. In some places, the formula works out better than others. In Washington County, they get a fair amount of money for that. It's not necessarily something that they would all call adequate. In other counties, in most counties, including Grand County, San Juan County, most counties in our state with any significant federal public land, it is literally pennies on the dollar for what they get. So that means that the county has to take it on the chin when it comes to public education, when it comes to search and rescue, when it comes to fire services, law enforcement. All of the things that your local government money goes toward are shortchanged as a result of the fact that the federal government, while claiming that it's making a payment in lieu of taxes, is actually paying pennies on the dollar. So in many circumstances, what we're talking about here is not whether or not to have public land. In fact, that's not what we're discussing at all. We're talking about who owns it, who manages it, what the circumstances are for its ownership and management. And that leads me to a question for you, Representative Albrecht. As a member of the Utah State Legislature, I'm sure you have a lot of conversations about public lands. And it's important to remember that public lands fall into a number of categories. We've talked here today a little bit about school trust lands, which serve one set of purposes, and state trust lands, as Councilman Wells pointed out, have a different destiny than other types of public lands. Many of them are, in fact, set aside and developed. Another category, things like our national parks, our national recreation areas, our wilderness, designated wilderness areas, are never going to be developed. That's the whole point, is to never develop them. Do you know anyone in the legislature, do you know of any significant support in the legislature, anybody who's even advocating for that? Or is what we're talking about really more at the margins, where we're talking about something that's neither military, nor state institutional trust lands, nor national park, nor national recreation area, nor national wilderness area, but something else? Garden variety BLM land and so forth.
Well, my grandparents, Brigham Young sent them to Sanbeep and then Sevier and then Wayne County. I grew up in Wayne County, population 2,200, little town called Bicknell, population 360, hasn't buried in 50 years.
Beautiful place over there.
My dad was a timberman, had a sawmill. There were 9 sawmills in Bicknell at one time when I was a young man. Now there's one that operates part-time. My dad also mined uranium on the San Rafael Swale during the uranium boom. Actually sold low-grade uranium to U.S. buying stations in Grand Junction, Nayarita, Shiprock, New Mexico for use to make bombs during the Cold War, to end in the Cold War. And ended up building two motels two restaurants there in that town and a store. So I was involved in tourism. That's kind of how it's evolved. As a state representative, we realize that Utah is a public land state. What we would really like is a seat at the table, if you will, in the management of some of these lands. I can give you a great example. You don't mind. In my prior life, before being a legislator, I managed a small rural electric cooperative in Senator McCaskey. You would know what those are in Alaska. But I worked for that little co-op for 40 years in south central Utah and northern Arizona. I was the manager for 23 years. I had to build transmission lines from Glen Canyon Dam to all these little towns that were surrounded by national parks, Bryce Canyon, Zion, Capitol Reef, and it was a difficult process. One line that I tried to build from Tropic Utah to Hatch, Utah, about 30 miles, crossed two Forest Service District offices, the BLM, the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, Bryce Canyon National Park, Sitla Trust Lands, and private lands. Then you couple that with sage grouse, prairie dogs, pygmy rabbit, and northern goshawk. Now that's a recipe for a long drawn out process. And it was. It took me 7 years to get the right-of-way. I found out, because the Forest Service was the lead agency out of Cedar City, that I needed Tom Vilsack's signature on that EIS. Tom Vilsack was the Secretary of Agriculture under President Obama. And I was in Florida one time, to a National Rural Electric Convention. Tom Vilsack was the keynote speaker. I said, we've got to get his attention after this. So I sent a fellow friend up one side of the convention hall that held 10,000 people, and I went up the other. And we met him behind the curtain. Or security met us, let's put it that way. And I said, I need to talk to that guy. And they said, no, you can't. So we followed him out to his limousine. And I said, give me 1 minute of your time. I gave him my card and I said, you're needed on the signature of an EIS for a project in Utah that serves a lot of constituents around the national parks. And he says, okay, let me think about it. I don't think I'm responsible for that. And I said, yes, the Secretary of Agriculture, because the Forest Service is under the Department of Ag, you are responsible. And you have to sign off. So I gave him my card. 2 weeks later, he called me and he said, yeah, I do need to sign off. And 2 weeks after that, he did sign off. And that project, after 7 years, finally was able to turn the shovel. Those are the kind of problems that we run into in rural Utah. If we just had a seat at the management table for some of these projects, I think we could operate them very efficiently. It's been alluded to, you know, the Utah Watershed Restoration Initiative, the Utah Shared Stewardship Action Plan now that we've just signed with Secretary Perdue on the forest. Those are the kind of things that we need to do. And because we've had a seat at the table and been able to work with our federal partners, we're getting some of those things done. So, hope that helps.
That's very helpful. Thank you. I want to emphasize, and I've seen some reminders this evening, of the fact that we are, in fact, a public land state. And as some of you are pointing out this evening, Article 3 of our state constitution acknowledges that the state of Utah relinquished the ownership of the federal public lands within our state's boundaries at statehood. This is also echoed in our statehood enabling legislation passed by Congress in 1894, 2 years before we were admitted into the Union. It's absolutely true. The state relinquished the title to it. But we have to remember that there was an understanding at the time that some of that land in time would be sold or would be transferred, and that land that was sold would produce revenue that would go into a trust fund for the benefit of the state's public education system. To my knowledge, there's not a single member of the legislature. To my knowledge, there's not a single member of Utah's congressional delegation. To my knowledge, there's not a single member of the U.S. House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate who believes that Utah should ever be anything but a public land state, who believes that Utah should ever privatize or sell any of the lands that we hold near and dear as crown jewels of our public land system, including and especially our national parks, our national recreation areas, and our declared wilderness. Not one. Not a single one. It's not what this is about. This is about the other stuff, the other land. What about the land that's not delicate arch, that's not double arch, that's just out there? Some of it's interspersed in urban or suburban or semi-urban or semi-suburban areas, or some of it in rural areas. What about that land? What about that land, especially when it's allowed to sit fallow, when it's allowed to grow wild, when it's allowed to build up fuel to such a degree that it presents a wildfire risk? What about that land where timber starts growing and where we can see decades in advance that a bark beetle infestation is coming? We warn the federal land managers about it and we ask them for permission to address it, and they tell us no. Then we see that infestation come after we've been denied the opportunity to defeat it, and then it works its course and it destroys millions of acres of timber. And then that timber being dead presents a wildfire risk, and we go to them and we ask for permission to remove the dead trees so that we can protect life and property in the area and our watersheds and our environment from the environmental devastation that we know will come. And then they tell us no. And then we wait, and lightning literally and metaphorically strikes, and the unthinkable happens. The entirely foreseeable happens. Lives are lost, value is lost, and devastation to the environment is brought about in a way that we won't ever be able to fully recover in our lifetimes. That's the question. It's not about whether we're going to have public lands. We always will. It's about who owns it and who manages it and to what extent it needs to be owned by the federal government. Not one of us in Congress, not one of us in the legislature, to my knowledge, thinks we ought to get rid of the national parks or the national recreation areas or declared wilderness. But at some point, one has to ask how much of that land has to be federal rather than owned by somebody else. Let's look at the map up there. This map over here shows that in every state to the east of Colorado, the federal government owns less than 15% of the land. I would ask, and sometimes I do ask, my colleagues from Illinois, from Massachusetts, from New York, from Texas, from Georgia, is your state an environmental hellscape? No. Do you suffer wildfires to the same degree that we do? No. What is it that you do in order to avoid that environmental devastation? Well, it's not environmentally catastrophic to not have all of your land federal. But I've just conceded that not one of us wants to get rid of any of these crown jewel lands. Not one of us. And yet, even if we kept all those in federal lands, plus our military installations, even if our state decided to abandon any interest in owning and managing any other lands, we'd still have well above the average of states east of Colorado. So, and we look at the fact that the states have been told that they can't tax those lands. Well, why is that the case? Has the federal government said so? And yet, consistent with the Constitution, I believe that a state retains that right, unless or until the state has voluntarily relinquished it. We've lost sight of that, as we've also lost sight of the understanding implicit in the Statehood Enabling Act that some of those lands would be sold and that a percentage of the proceeds of the sale of that land would be put into a trust fund for the benefit of the state's public education system. If you're against that, then I think you should make the argument to the state's school children and to the parents of those children. But there is no reason why we have to accept the false choice between whether we're going to be a public land state or not. We're never not going to be. Not one of us would advocate otherwise. Congressman Bishop, have you confronted this argument in Congress? Is this something that you have addressed, this notion that those who want reform in this area, those who understand that there are some benefits that can come from state public land ownership and management, are mistakenly characterized as wanting to abandon the concept of public land itself?
It happens all the time back in D.C., because I think people don't quite get it and get the concept of it. But I think it was part of the things you were talking about earlier. Do states, people who live in states and work for states or local governments, do they have the ability of actually managing land? And the idea is actually, yeah. So the first national park was Yellowstone. The second national park was Adirondack, which was returned to the state because the state could do a better job at the management of it. The one in New York, was in Michigan. Adirondack's in New York. Same thing, though. It was returned to the state. Yosemite started as federal, then went to the state, and then came back to the federal government. So can states manage it? Well, look at what Grand County is doing
Sand
Flats, and what the state's doing down at Coral Sand Dunes, and it can happen. Sometimes, though, what I find out is that we get so tied up in Washington with rules and regulations and standards that we don't do things that are practical. For example, I went down to Hot Springs National Park in Arkansas because that was the site of the very first spring training for baseball ever. The park director down there is from Hot Springs, and she repeatedly went through and told us what she authorized and what she did that totally violated Park Service regulations, and she did it because it was the right thing to do to create a better experience for people who were going down there. And sometimes it takes somebody with a love of that community, that was born and raised in that community, that understands that community, to make some decisions, even breaking some of the rules, if it's in the best interest of developing and allowing people to have a better experience on those lands. And so all wisdom doesn't happen to be residing in Washington or bureaus in Washington. That's why if everyone was talking about partnerships, having federal lands is not bad out here if they will actually work with the people around them to make sure the experience is positive. I think Dave probably has a better example than I do.
Dave?
Growing up in Camas Valley and throughout the entire state of Utah, in the late 50s, all through the 60s, and even in the mid-70s, it was under the mandate of the National Forest Service that a local person who was working for the Forest Service had to live in that town. Therefore, when they went to church, when they went to the grocery store, when they went to the school, they understood how their decisions they made as that local Forest Service person affected the entire community. We didn't have dead trees because of the bark beetle. We had very few forest fires because the local Forest Service was on top of every project and knew what happened. And then in about the mid-70s, we started saying, okay, a person from Salt Lake can get in his truck at 8 o'clock in the morning. He can drive to Camas and get there by 9:15. He can put in his time until 4 o'clock, and then he can drive back to Salt Lake. And he never had the opportunity of associating or socializing with the people on the ground who really were being affected by his decisions. The same thing took place 4 years ago when I was on the county council. I worked for 4 years with the Northern Forest Service Administrator to try and put people on the ground on what they call the North Slopes up there, on the North Slopes going into Wyoming, because that's the watershed for the entire Wasatch Front. The entire Wasatch Front. And those trees have been dead going on 8 or 9 years. I have always said, even from the first time, about 10 years ago when I was on the county council, if we don't start to address that, it's a matter of not it, but when it will burn, and it will burn clear to Wyoming, it'll get in all four of the rivers, Bear Lake, the Duchesne, the Provo, and the Weber. And if that fire starts, you'll have sediment come off that'll entirely destroy the drinking source of all of Wasatch Front. And it will take years and billions of dollars to put it back in place. The trouble was, the Forest Service was managing roadless area as if it were wilderness area. And I can tell you, my county council, made up of people from the Park City side, supported me 110%. And they were environmentalists. But they understood that if we didn't act, someone was going to act in our place. And Brian Conn can now verify, they're up there working on it. Some 10 years later, where now we're having to pay people to go in and remove those trees. Had we started 10 years earlier, that salvage value of those trees would have been worth something. So it's a round circle that we need to, we all need to sit down at the table and understand where we're coming from. Nora, whatever her last name is, down in Ogden, her hands were tied by the people above her. They wouldn't give her the opportunity of going in and opening up those roads. And salvaging that timber while it was still worth something. Now we're paying a heck of a price, and we better pray that there's not a fire up there or the Wasatch Front will never survive.
So those who can see this problem coming and have seen problems like that coming in the past within federal agencies, I mean, surely they don't refuse to act or refuse to allow action or delay action until it's too late because they hate the environment. Surely they don't want our water poisoned. Surely they don't want to contaminate our pristine environment within our state. Why are they delaying? Why do they refuse to act?
I believe it's because the local person is not giving that authority. And the people in Washington or the people in Denver do not understand what the circumstances are. And therefore, they tell the regional forester, well, I don't think you read that right. Because I'm from Washington and I know a heck of a lot more than you do because I have a higher position. We have to form partnerships at the local level. And that means that the federal lands can be used, multiple uses. We can have recreation, we can have grazing on it, we can have timbering. Because if you don't have timbering and take care of those dead trees, you're not going to have any of the above.
Yes, Representative Albert.
A prime example of working together has been the Monroe Mountain Working Group on the Fish Lake National Forest. There's been over 20 some odd agencies involved. Brian Cottle could also address this, but that was a mountain that was sick, totally sick, and it needed restoration. And there's been a lot of money spent from the state and the feds and other organizations, conservation groups working together. It's now coming around. They've cut a lot of that dead timber that was beetle killed out. You've got to restore the quake and aspen to the wildlife situation there because the quake and aspen holds the moisture in the forest. It's not the conifers. The Doug fir and the Engelmann spruce drink it by the gallon. The quake and aspen retains the water. And that's critical for the watersheds. We lost the watershed for penguins with that fire on Cedar Mountain. Totally lost it. And now we're spending millions on restoration for wells and new water facilities. Those folks had to truck in water for their municipal uses. That's unacceptable. But the Monroe Mountain Working Group is a group of feds and state and other organization conservation groups that's working together to rehabilitate that mountain. It can be done, Senator.
How much help from the federal government do you get on the restoration side? We were talking about some of the impact again to these smaller communities after some of these devastating fires and the erosion then that comes and the damage that is left long, long after incident commanders have come and gone, long after those federal fire dollars come to you. So can you somebody speak to the issue of what we see from the federal government for the restoration, whether it's fire or otherwise?
consider. So what the Senator's talking about is the total cost of wildfire and what we focus on. We don't in Utah, because for my division and myself, we really push the notion of the total cost of wildfire and helping people better understand it's not just suppression. We always talk about that because that's the flames and that's the firefighters, that's what gets the news. But suppression costs of wildfire are minimal compared to the total cost. These are ongoing costs, they're externalized, they're often accounted for, but they are real. And it's local government that pays for these ongoing or total costs of wildfire. And they pay for it because the effects are often on private land or the adjacent lands. And once the fire goes out, federal agencies will, in our case, often the Forest Service, they will restore the lands that they are responsible for, but that's the only authority they have, the only funding they have. But all of the other costs, they fall on state and local government. Folks, if you really understood how much local government pays when it comes to wildfire on federal lands, you'd be up in arms. It's magnitudes more. It's tens of times more. And we are all paying these costs. We've got to do so much better. And it's all about wildfire risk reduction. It's not waiting for the fires to come and react. It's all the work that we need to be doing up front in our communities with federal agencies, Forest Service in particular, to reduce wildfire risk. We can't go on spending so many billions of dollars on suppression and then all of those other costs that local taxpayers have to bear for years to come to deal with that. Federal agencies provide a little bit of support depending on the needs. National Resources Conservation Service, which is part of the USDA, they have funding that can provide support, but these costs are falling on us, state and local government. It's unacceptable.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left before we've got to close. I thought I'd set aside a minute or two for each of the congressmen and then for Senator Murkowski, and then I'll wrap it up after that. Congressman, go, sir.
Well, thank you, Senator. Thanks for having me. You know, inherently, every state should be given the same aspects that the original states were given. There's an implied contract between the public lands, between the states and the federal government. It's broken. You look at return on investment, which is what the charge was, and Congress has to mitigate that. You know, you look at what Brian was talking about. The total cost of wildfire. We need to start talking about the carbon release and the pollution that comes with catastrophic fire. You want to talk about carbon sequestration if you're looking at climate change. Here's your biggest carbon sink ever. And it's a dynamic forest. It's not an old growth forest. It's a young, medium, old growth, all mixed in together. Dynamic. That's purpose. And if you want to take a look at what failure looks like, look at the public lands in the way that we look at the endangered species. If I'm a physician and I put 100 people in the hospital and only 3 come out, that's great for those 3 people. But what about the 97? I'm in healthcare. Those aren't results that you actually are astounded by. And the only way we get better is by including the people at local control that are vested in that. If that forest burns, I'm not gonna have people coming back to go hiking, biking, fishing, hunting. They're not. But that's not what is seen back in Washington, D.C. That's why I think we still have to look at this and look at the complications of this. This is a stewardship between both, and it can be done. Thanks, Senator.
Congressman Bishop.
This is John's area. Let me yield to him. And that way I can just mock him later on without having to be public about it.
Fantastic. Congressman Curtis.
I'm speechless, Congressman. He's never yielded time to me in Washington, D.C. I'm just not quite sure what to do. I think he's going to take this time back in Washington, D.C.
Enjoy it while you got it.
I'll be very brief. I can't tell you how honored I am to serve this area. I believe that I represent the most archaeologically rich district in the entire United States. I represent this county, San Juan County, with Bears Ears, Emory County with the swell, Carbon County, and each rich and unique in the diversity of issues and people. And to be honest, I'm probably close to the new guy at these tables, if not the newest guy. I've been in Congress now not quite 2 years. during that period of time, I feel like I've seen the best of human interaction, and to be honest, the worst of human interaction as it deals with these public lands. That gives me hope that we can do it, that we can come together, that we can find consensus, that we can move forward in a way that's really best for the people and for the land and for the stakeholders. But it also gives me caution that when not careful, when we come together with divisiveness and looking for each other's faults, that we'll find them. I like to tell people, if you look for the worst in me, you'll find it, right? If you look for the best in me, I think you'll find it too. So I just put out a plea to all of us to look for the best. I think one of the things that breaks my heart the most is the villainization of the local people from my colleagues back in the East. And somehow they villainize them and make them out to be the bad guys. I love to preach in Washington that the best environmentalists I know are here in Utah, and they're the local people who have done a wonderful job. So once again, I just express my appreciation and the honor it is to serve all of you, and look forward to navigating some of these very, very difficult issues with you and finding answers.
Thank you. Senator Murkowski.
Senator Lee, thank you for making this conversation happen today. I keep going back to the map, the map that is really, in fairness, I hate to tell you, I hate those maps, because that little state down in the corner is not accurately represented. One of these days I'll bring my own map and we'll position it so that you get that full effect. It is. It's awkward for the map makers, but... It teaches young children that Alaska sits somewhere down near Mexico, and they wonder why we're the land of ice and snow. But that map is instructive, because that just demonstrates the reality of this amazing place that we call the United States of America. When we were settled, when they came across from Europe and met up with the native peoples who had been here for thousands of years, and the push to settle after we had been in the East for a while, the push going west, it's different here in the West. It's different than what we know in the East. And it doesn't make one good or bad, it's just different. And understanding what it is that we deal with in the West by those who are in the East is an important part of what we all need to try to better understand. And I think sometimes we make assumptions that other people get it, because in fairness, in every state in the Union, there is rural places. There's rural places in New York and in the center of the country, in Hawaii, there's rural everywhere. But rural is very different. You get out here and you can see rural, and you get to my state, you're never going to be able to drive to rural because there's no roads to take you there. It's just rural and it's big. And how we care for one another and how we care for our lands is a great and ultimate and beautiful challenge. But we can't do it if we silo ourselves. And if we say that it's just the federal government's responsibility, or it's just the states, or it's just the tribes, it is how we work across agencies. It's how we get out of our silos. It's how we cooperate with one another. And I keep coming back to the examples of fire. Fire doesn't care where the county line is. It doesn't care where the state line is. It doesn't care whether it's BLM or private or your state lands. It just doesn't care. And at the end of the day, how we come together to care for all of these lands is the ultimate charge and responsibility. So we have challenges. I agree with you, Representative Kurtz. We're challenged, but we can figure these things out. Because at the end of the day, This is what we've got. This is what you've got. You all mentioned your family ties that go back generations, ties to this land. You're probably going to be here for a long time, and your family's families are going to be here for a long time. And maybe you like the neighbors, but I think it's probably that you're very, very tied to the land, as so many of us are. So how we work together to resolve these differences is again the big challenge, and it comes about with dialogue. It comes with people speaking up with a passion about what they care for, and I appreciate those that have taken the time today to be here to be part of this discussion and this dialogue, and I thank you for helping make the conversation happen.
Thanks so much, Senator Brankowski, and thank you for being here. Thank you for your support on the committee for holding this event. Senator Brankowski is someone who is a giant in the Senate, who was able to work with people of all political backgrounds and does so in a bipartisan fashion that results in good legislation, and she's to be commended. So you're a dear friend and a fine lawmaker, and I'm honored to have you in our state. I'm grateful to all of you for coming this evening for this conversation. And I've thought a lot about public lands in recent years since I've been privileged to serve in the United States Senate. And I'm reminded of the fact that when you poll the American people, whether it's people in Utah or just about anywhere else, about what they like about the federal government, the National Park Service is nearly always at or near the top of the list. People like the national parks. They like public lands. They like these crown jewels that we have access to. A stone's throw from where we sit right now. By the way, you want to know what the least popular part of the federal government is? Congress. We have an institutional approval rating that hovers at around 11%, which makes us less popular than Fidel Castro and many other former dictators in America.
You don't need to remind us.
Right, but it's an interesting fact, you know. And only slightly more popular than the influenza virus, which is inexplicably gaining ground on us. Reminds me of this plaque that my dad had in his office. He, like me, was a lawyer. I was a lawyer before I went to the Senate, and it said, "Yes, I'm a lawyer. Don't tell my mother. She thinks I play the piano in a bordello." But, you know, it's not all bad there. And it's not as partisan as the media would sometimes have you believe. There is a fair amount of bipartisanship. Sometimes take heat for the fact that I got a shout out from Bernie Sanders during the Democratic debate last week. Bernie Sanders is a friend. Bernie Sanders and I have worked on legislation, including an historic piece of legislation earlier this year to get us out of an undeclared unconstitutional civil war in Yemen. Bernie and I don't agree on everything, but we do agree that unconstitutional wars are bad. Sometimes people back home will ask me, "Why on earth are you working with Bernie Sanders?" And I'll say, "Well, sometimes the federal government does things that it shouldn't do. And it does, in fact, operate the world's largest, most powerful military force. We've got to utilize that carefully. When we don't, people get hurt and people die." And I get criticized occasionally for working for 8 years on a major generational criminal justice reform package. I started working with a liberal Democratic friend of mine named Dick Durbin. Dick Durbin is a liberal Democrat from Illinois. I'm never described as a liberal or as a Democrat. But we worked on criminal justice reform to bring down minimum mandatory penalties in the federal system. People criticize me at home, sometimes saying, "Why are you doing that?" And I say, "Well, the federal government's big, and when it sends people to prison for decades at a time for selling 3 dime bags of marijuana, people get hurt. When the federal government misuses its authority, it harms individuals and it harms society." My reasons for seeking reform on public lands are the same, and they are potentially equally bipartisan. I seek reform in this area for a number of reasons, not the least of which is concern for the environment. Our environment has, in fact, been harmed. It has been harmed affirmatively, unmeasurably, irreversibly, by bad policy. Now, it's not because anyone running these agencies happens to be a bad person. That's not the case. It's simply because of the fact that we have gotten out of balance in where we manage these lands. In other words, I'm for reform in this area, not in spite of concern for the environment, but because of it. rebalancing how we manage these things not only will bring environmental benefits that will be to the benefit of our children and grandchildren after them, it also will bring other benefits when it comes to our ability to fund our public education system. Historically, our state's public education system has done a remarkable job at educating our children, notwithstanding the fact that our per pupil funding rate has tended to be on the lower end of the spectrum. Imagine how much more we could do if our local governments and our school districts were adequately funded. We can do this, and we can especially do so in a way that pays more respect for the environment while maintaining the benefits that we enjoy from access to public lands. We can do this together if we work on it. And I thank you for coming here. I want to thank each of our participants, each of these experts who have come and have traveled great distance to be here, and I thank each of you. Thank you very much. We stand adjourned. Thank you very much. We stand adjourned. Thank you very much.